Welcome back to the Crash Course Podcast. My name is Craig Crash Collins, and joined the man, the myth, the legend is back. B. Scott is here after a little hiatus. We're glad to have you back, B. Scott. Obviously, you know, well wishes go out to your family and all the stuff that's going on right now, but we're glad to have you back. And not only do we have B. Scott back, he has reports from like live sports, which is, this is something we haven't had in a while, B. Scott.
I know. And just the fact that, you know, right now, you know, I'm on furlough at the NCAA, so I have time to actually go to live sports. Because there is live sports to go to. So, I'm super excited to be back. And what better topics to come back to than football and racing? I mean, it's like, yeah, it's the right fit.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot going on. IndyCar returns for the third time to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway this year. That's, what you got a chance to attend, and that was pretty cool, B. Scott. Also, you've got, you know, the Indianapolis Colts. They're off to a 3-1 start. We'll touch on that as well. And we'll also talk about the Big Ten football schedule. And then we'll talk about, you know, Big Ten football coming back, which, you know, isn't necessarily like fresh off the page news, but also just kind of, it's one of those things. So B. Scott, I talked about last week when I previewed the MLB playoffs, that like basically we did our MLB preview, and then like the next day they announced that the playoffs would be expanded, which pretty much threw everything out the window. That's kind of what happened with my college football preview as well. I said, okay, you know what, this is how it'll look like with no Big Ten and Pac-12, and then like 2 weeks later they're like, just kidding, we're back. So we get to kind of do a do-over on that kind of stuff. So it's going to be a lot of fun. So let's go ahead and hop right back into it. So this weekend was the IndyCar Harvest Grand Prix, race one, was the most exciting. That one was on Friday. You had 12 lead changes among six drivers. Joseph Newgarden led 34 laps. He took the lead at lap 67 and never looked back, led the final 18 there. Alexander Rossi, Rinus VK, Colton Herta, and Felix Rosenquist rounded out the top five. And then race two was fantastic. If you were a fan of Will Power, if you weren't,
it was fantastic for second place on back as well.
I got
it,
you.
It really was.
Yeah. So it's like, but Will Power leads all 75 laps of the race. Colton Herta, Alexander Rossi, Joseph Newgarden, and Patricio Award rounded out the top five. So B. Scott, I'll kind of give you the floor because you went to the race. What was it like to not only be back at a live sporting event, but also just to be back and see racing at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, which, you know, we were not able to do in our normal date in May. We were not able to do for the Brickyard, not able to do for the Indy.
We haven't been able to do it at all this year.
Yeah, exactly.
It was great. They, like, as a lot of people know, they were only allowing up to 10,000 people in on each day. And they separated 5,000 in one turn of the oval, and then 5,000 in the another turn. So turn one of the oval and turn four of the oval. I sat in, I was in the North Vista. It was kind of nice. It was a wheelchair section and there was no other wheelchair. So my buddy and I had our own private viewing mound, essentially. So we could socially distance the best we possibly could. But it was just awesome just to be back and see those cars out on the track and the respect that they have for the fans being in the stands. Matter of fact, even after race number two, Takuma Sato went off the road course and drove around part of the oval and to salute the fans after his 500 victory. So that was really kind of cool to see. He actually ended up stopping his car and hopping out right in front of us. So that was one of the really cool big highlights of the weekend. But looking at both of the races, race one, yeah, it had a lot of lead changes. It had a lot of different strategies being played out. You had probably about, I want to say about 25% of the field started on the primary the reds, and then the rest of them started on the primary blacks. As you know, in IndyCar racing on the road courses and street courses, the reds are a much faster tire compound, but they do wear out quickly. And the blacks, they have a longer shelf life, essentially. You can run longer on those, but you do not have the same kind of speed. Well, this past weekend, because of the temperatures and how cool it was, you basically took that and you threw it out the window. the primary blacks were still had great longevity. They were still slow for some cars. Some cars could really find some good speed with those primary blacks. However, it was really beneficial to have reds on because you could run the reds for so long because of the cool temperatures. A matter of fact, Joseph Newgarden in race number one, he started off on primary, or he started off on the reds, and he actually stretched it out for a 21 laps, which is really, really good, considering he was one of the last people to actually pit in the first pit cycle. So because of that, they did go have to do a three stop strategy. But the next day, a lot of people started on the primary blacks for race two, and they actually went with a two-stop strategy. So it was really cool seeing different strategies play out over the two races. When Joseph Newgarden did eventually take the lead, he did take the lead away in race one from from Colton Herta, and it wasn't really a race move that Joseph did. He really put some pressure on Herta going into turn one on the road course, which caused Herta to lock up his brakes and go right through the turn. So that allowed Joseph then to take the lead. That was probably one of the most exciting events of the entire weekend. Now in race two, like you said, Will Power just kind of ran away with it. Led all 75 laps from start to finish, just had a really dominant car. However, there was a really good battle going on for second and third place. As the race was winding down, it looked like for a while there, Alexander Rossi was actually going to run down Will Power. However, Colton Herta had himself another fast car as well and, you know, had a clean race. He was actually able to run down Rossi and get by him, but there just wasn't enough laps. And Herta was actually closing in quickly on Will Power. And Herta was one of those drivers also that did find the speed on the primary blacks. So that was a really cool race there at the end. Had it been the 85 like it was on for race one on Friday, I do believe Colton Herta probably could have gotten by Will Power. But overall, it was a great weekend of racing, capped off by on Sunday the GT Continental Tire or North American Tire Challenge 8-hour endurance race. You know, you had every kind of condition in that race: rain, cold, sun, warm. I mean, you basically hit three of the four seasons in that race alone, and getting to see some of those cars, different types like Bentleys, Ferraris. It kind of breaks your heart a little bit when you see a Ferrari hit the wall and going into the front straightaway off the last turn on the road course, or a Bentley get crashed out by a McLaren. You know, it kind of gut punch there to see that expensive of a car. You know, you're used to seeing NASCAR or IndyCar, you're seeing wrecks with those cars, but man, seeing a street looking car type car in a Ferrari hit the wall. Ooh, that was tough. But yeah, it was definitely a great all around weekend of racing. It was just great to be back at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It wasn't just the drivers, you know, that were happy to see the fans. It was everybody. It was drivers all the way down to the yellow shirts. And if you've ever been to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, you know exactly who I'm talking about when I'm talking about the yellow shirts. They were super appreciative just to have fans in the stands. It didn't matter if there was like two fans in their section. They were just super glad that you were there and got to enjoy racing with them, because they're all extremely passionate about racing as well. It was just great to be back in one of the happiest places on earth.
Yeah, it sounds like a fantastic weekend. And it's something, I don't know, you know, I was thinking about it. I was like, you know what? Like a doubleheader weekend, I don't know what it does to, like, you know, the month of May in general, but like I would think that would be a good idea for just the month of May in general. I mean, I don't know if you could ever do three weekends at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway again, as far as like in a normal year, but if they were
they are going to do three weekends.
That's been confirmed for like next year.
So this kind of goes into our next topic here with racing. This last week, it was announced that the Brickyard 400 starting in 2021 will no longer be run on the oval. It is going to be run on the road course.
Right, which is a great move, in my opinion.
Yes. And yes. Instead of being in July, on July 4th weekend, they're going to move it closer to the original weekend in August. This weekend is actually going to be a doubleheader with IndyCar. again. So very much like what we saw over the 4th of July weekend this year with the running of the Indy Grand Prix, and then the Xfinity Series was on the road course, and then the Cup Series was on the oval. It's going to be very similar to that. You're going to have IndyCar on Saturday on the road course, Xfinity on Saturday on the road course, and then the Cup cars on Sunday on the road course. So yeah, technically you're going to have IndyCar there for three race weekends. You're going to have the regular Indy GP, and then you're going to have the Indy 500, and then this race that's going to be in August as well.
Yeah, I now that you mentioned that, like, I do remember like that being a thing that was announced. So like, yeah, that's a great move, and I think it, you know, no brainer move to move the Brickyard to the road course. I think the oval version of the Brickyard has kind of run its course. You kind of still keep Indianapolis on the schedule, and I think this will make for a better race. You know, you talked about when, you know, that weekend happened this year with the Xfinity Series. That the Xfinity Series on the road course was super exciting. So I think it's a great move for the NASCAR guys to get onto the road course. And then for all those purists that didn't like NASCAR on the oval and thought the Indy 500 should be the only thing on the oval, well, now you've got your wish. Pretty much everything now is on the road course except for the Indy 500.
Right. I think it's a great move as well. I mean, how many times did I say that on this show?
Yeah.
Anytime we talked about the Brickyard and how it's just not the same anymore, and how it really needs to get moved I would love it if it got moved to the road course, or if they put in lights and did it at night. But obviously they're doing it the road course because of what we saw in the Xfinity Series race this year and just how exciting that was. Even the last 10 laps were probably the most epic last 10 laps we've seen with us for stock cars in a very long time at IMS. So I think this is a great move. I know there are some NASCAR fans and NASCAR drivers that are a little disappointed that they aren't going to be running on the oval anymore just because of how iconic it is. But like IMS president Doug Bull said, you're still going to be running down that famed straightaway along the pagoda. You're still going to be driving over the Yard of Bricks. The only difference is you're just not going to be, you're going the opposite direction, and you're going to have several more turns than you typically do. But this is going to be a great, great move, not just for the NASCAR series, but for Indianapolis Motor Speedway as well. It's going to bring a lot of fans in again. We'll see. I think it will. I think this year it could have brought in a lot of fans. And it's going to be one of those events that we could possibly see Jimmy Johnson running. Obviously he's going to be running the road and street races in IndyCar for Chip Ganassi. And he said he may have a couple one-off races in NASCAR. And that might be a great opportunity for him to have a one-off race because he's already going to be there. So I think it's going to be a great opportunity. I think this was the right move moving forward. Now, that doesn't mean that they will always be on the road course. They're never going to go back to the oval. I can't say for certain.
Right.
I know they couldn't even say for certain. Is there a chance maybe that in the future they add the oval back on and still have the road course? Yeah, that's a possibility as well.
I mean, I think a double
always changing.
I think a double header with the road course and the actual and the oval as well would be a cool thing. So like, do kind of a, you know, standalone. It's just the Xfinity or just the Cup Series, not the Xfinity Series, and do like a Friday race on the oval and a Sunday race on the road course or something like that. I think that might be pretty cool. Make a weekend out of it.
I think that'd be great. But I think having three races across three series and two types of cars, I think that's going to be a huge, great first step into really building the excitement around these events.
Now we want to take this time to remind you that you can follow us at Crash Course FM on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook, Crash Course Podcast. Make sure you check out the YouTube channel, Crash Course Podcast. We have a new memory lane coming out on Friday. It is the 2013 Big Ten Championship between Michigan State and Ohio State. That was a 12-1 or a team, two teams that ended up being 12-1, a top 10 matchup. So you won't miss that. Yeah, dude.
I got that one.
Yeah, that one was an exciting one for sure. So make sure you check out episode 10 of Memory Lane coming out on Friday. Then remember, you can listen weekly on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever podcasts can be heard. You can hear the Crash Course Podcast. So, that's not been the only thing that's got Indy a buzz is the IndyCar series coming back this weekend. Also, the Colts are 3-1, which is pretty crazy. The Colts are 3-1, second in the AFC East by technicality. I mean, it's because the Titans did not play this weekend, so technically that puts the Colts still a half game back because they're 3-1. The Titans are 3-0. They just a quick recap of their season so far. Lost opening weekend, kind of a surprising loss there. Not kind of, it was. They lost 27-20 to the Jaguars. But then they come back, three straight wins over the Vikings, 28-11, the Jets, 36-7. And then this past weekend over the Bears, 19-11. So that puts their record at 3-1. Their offense has looked better. It looks okay. It's looked serviceable. They're 18th right now in passing yards per game. Phillip Rivers is 21st in QBR, where you kind of really kind of expected him to be. Week one versus Jacksonville, he threw one touchdown and two interceptions. Since then, he's thrown four touchdowns and just been picked off once. So Phillip Rivers has improved as the season's gone along. And then the rushing game has definitely obviously missed Marlon Mack, who was out really almost, you know, first possession of the season, basically. He tears his Achilles and he's out for the season. So the running game, Jonathan Taylor has stepped up and has been very good. But the rushing offense is still only 18th in the league as far as yards are concerned. But the big story has been the defense. They're first in yards per game, passing yards per game, and points per game allowed. They're fourth against the run, and they're fourth in turnover differential. They're plus four now. So the defense has played out of their minds, and that is actually, you know, really honestly the surprise of the season so far. You know, it's what you expected to see record-wise. I know I had Jacksonville chalked up as a win, so theoretically, as far as, you know, my season prediction was concerned, they should be 4-0. But at the same time, I didn't expect Minnesota to be quite so bad, so I thought that would be kind of a toss-up game. So it's kind of equaled itself out. So, you know, for a team that I expected to be 3-1, or, you know, for a team I expected to finish the season either 12-4 or 10-6 between that mark, you know, they're right on schedule as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I'm kind of pleasantly surprised. Well, I guess maybe not. My reaction is basically, you know, this is kind of what we I don't know if this is truly what we fully expected out of this team. I think we did think the offense was going to be a lot better. And I think there was a lot of question marks with the defense, particularly the secondary, and it's kind of flip-flopped. The defense is living above expectation and the offense is playing below expectation. But this is one of those teams that I still don't have a good read quite yet, right, on that, mostly because of how weak the schedule has ultimately turned out to be. Obviously, Jacksonville came out of the gate. The Colts have never fared well at Jacksonville, even with Peyton Manning. They didn't fare well at Jacksonville. I mean, how many times have the Colts gone down to Jacksonville, been huge favorites, and it go down and absolutely lay an egg?
Well, and also I didn't realize this until you know, Chris, who's you know, a friend of the show, Chris Simmons from Indiana SRN, he said that, you know, the Colts haven't won in week one since 2013. So, you know, you kind of have a recipe for disaster, and they got to go to Jacksonville week one.
Right. And you got a new quarterback.
Right.
You have a rookie starting all over the field as well. It was kind of just one of those recipes for disaster. So when looking back on it, honestly, that loss wasn't too terribly surprising. Was it disappointing? Yes, because there was a lot of, man, that could have really set the Colts up well, especially because they're going to be going into a stretch here soon, post bye week, even this next week, having to go to Cleveland. I mean, what Cleveland just did to Dallas.
Right.
Yeah, now Dallas is only a one-win team, and they're playing in a division that's an absolute dumpster fire. That the division leader is 1-2-1, I believe.
Yep. And that's only because the only reason they're leading is because they won this past weekend over the 49ers, the Eagles. But yeah, to imagine getting your first win in week four and that vaunts you to the top of your division.
Yeah. So I feel like right now the Cleveland Browns are playing inspired football. I'm not going to say, you know, they're playing great football. They're playing inspired football. And that could all, I mean, honestly, looking forward, that could be their biggest downfall, is the fact that, hey, you know, they'll get too confident. And, you know, I feel like that's what the Colts were. They were too confident going into week one. And obviously it didn't work out in their favor. But, you know, the Colts, it was nice to see them to see them finally get a road win. They haven't won many games on the road the past few years. And to get a road win against the Chicago Bears, yeah, they were an undefeated team. Yeah, I know, it's the Bears. But, I mean, they still came from behind to beat the Falcons, the Lions. They've played pretty well, even though they've had to make a switch at quarterback. And, you know, Nick Foles, he can come off the bench and win you a Super Bowl. He's done it before, and he, you know, it's just many times he's not the player coming off the bench is when he struggles, it seems like. But, I think they are right where they need to be, but it's still too early to tell based on their schedule who this team really is. What really worries me, there's a couple things that really stand out to me that worry me the most. One, the offensive line hasn't been as dominant as advertised. Yeah, Phillip Rivers is protected very well. They're as advertised in pass protection. For me, I'm a little more worried about the run game and the run blocking. This past weekend, they just didn't look like themselves. I mean, obviously, you had Anthony Costanzo go down with a rib injury. I don't know if there is an injury that Quentin Nelson's battling. He just didn't look quite like himself either. It may just be, you know, he may be just fighting a flu bug or something. You just don't know. But they've been healthy, but they at the same time, they have shown up on the injury report at one point or time throughout the weeks. So that's a little concerning. The biggest concern for me, though, has to be the offense and their inability to put the ball in the end zone. It seems like they outside of the Jets, obviously, they are like averaging on offense 1 to 2 touchdowns per game.
Right.
And that's not going to get the job done. Yeah, you have a really good defense, but going up against a team like Cleveland this next weekend, if Cleveland gets going, are you going to be able to compete in a shootout? Are you going to be able to compete in a shootout against a Kansas City? I mean, well, probably not. Nobody can really compete in a shootout against Kansas City. Let's be honest, but it is a little concerning there and how they get down into the red zone and it's just, they fall flat. You know, it's like, man, what is going on? Now, the nice thing is the emergence of Mo Alie-Cox has helped. Trey Burton is back. Jack Doyle's basically been non-existent. Wide receiver is the scariest position for me, not in a good way. Like, you can say, oh, like, we'll get into it later, but Purdue, that's a scary wide receivers room in a good way. But the Colts, their wide receiver situation is scary. T.Y. is effectively, he's gone. The ghost is ghosted. And I do not know what to think of that. Obviously, the guy that was looking like to be the number one target, Paris Campbell, out for the year. Michael Pittman, out for the foreseeable future with a leg injury. Desmond Patton, another rookie, hasn't seen the field yet, hasn't even dressed yet because of injuries. I mean, right now, it's this wide receiving core is looking like much like it did last year, being led by Zach Pascal, Denoris Fountain. I mean, they just re-signed Krishan Hogan, who's basically a practice squad guy. It is very concerning looking at the wide receiving position for the Colts and just seeing how the lack of production is there. When now you have a quarterback that can throw the ball. I mean, he may not always be the most accurate, but he can throw the ball far, and that deep passing game should be there, but they just don't have the weapons to be able to do that. And I think eventually that's going to come back and bite them in the butt. That's going to haunt them eventually if they cannot get a ton of points up on the board. Now, thank goodness for Rodrigo Blankenship And thank goodness for the defense. I mean, if the defense hasn't been having pick sixes or causing turnovers or just playing absolutely dominant, this Colts season could be completely flipped around. I mean, they could be honestly 2-2, to be honest.
Right.
And I'm saying that because Minnesota and the game against the Vikings and the Jets, those were complete blowouts because of the defense. And the offense actually played well too. But, you know, the Bears game, the offense just wasn't in sync. And obviously against Jacksonville as well. So those are the things that concern me the most moving forward. And I think I'm really hoping that they do look for some help at wide receiver or even look to make some trades, even if it means having to ship out T.Y. Hilton. I don't know what's wrong. I really do not know what's wrong. So yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, I think these next few games, especially the rest of I think the rest of October will kind of be okay. Like even if they lose the Browns, they should beat the Bengals. They'll be at 4-2 heading into their bye week. But yeah, the next stretch of games is going to be kind of the biggest kind of gut check. You know, their next three games are the Browns, Bengals, Lions. You know, if, you know, depending on which Browns team shows up, that's a little scary, but you like to think that through the end of that run, they would be 5-2, but then they've got the Ravens at the Titans, the Packers again, then at home against the Titans. Now there is a little bit of breath of fresh air at the end of that tunnel, because they do have, you know, the Texans twice after that, which, you know, the Texans just fired, Bill O'Brien. Brian is the only thing that came to my brain. I was like, well, Brian's one of his names. I just can't think of the, but yeah, Bill O'Brien, you know, just got fired after an 0-4 start, and that team seems to not be, you know, where they want to be. So that kind of opens things up as far as, you know, what you think the division might look like. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are some big question marks. Now, Mo Alie-Cox actually is one of the bigger surprises for me. I mean, he leads the team in receiving yards. He's only got 194 so far, but it's still two touchdowns. You know, he's kind of been, you know, Phillip Rivers' go-to guy. And then, you know, yeah, you know what? Thank God for Rodrigo Blankenship, because he's also on my fantasy team and he's, you know, bringing home the points right now. So that's nice as well. But yeah, you're absolutely right. These next stretch of games, especially this week, because I mean, you look at the quarterbacks that the Colts have faced over the first four games. I mean, Gardner Minshew, you know, as much as I like the swagger and the bravado, like, you know, you feel like you should be able to, you know, beat a Gardner Minshew-led team. Then you've got Kirk Cousins, who outside of Adam Thielen has no one to throw to. And then week three against the Jets, I mean, it's Sam Darnold, who, you know, I don't really know. You know, this is what, you know, year four or five for him as far as, you know, he got drafted and hasn't really done much since then. So the Jets still kind of believe in him, but he's not really been much as far as the NFL is concerned. So, yeah, these next few weeks where they have Baker Mayfield and Joe Burrow and Matt Stafford and, you know, even though those are not all teams that you necessarily would normally be scared of, the Browns, Bengals, and Lions, those are obviously an upgrade as far as the quarterbacks that you've seen over the first 4 weeks of the season. So that'll kind of actually kind of let you know, if the Colts still play well defensively, because I mean, I don't expect the Colts to end the season with the number one ranked defense. That's not going to happen. Everything's going to kind of take care of itself. Like the Colts offense should theoretically, you know, in theory improve. The Colts defense in theory should also decline. Now it's just whether or not that decline for the defense is steep. And if that, you know, incline, the increase of production offensively is where you want to see it. So these next few weeks will be very telling for the Indianapolis Colts.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I don't think the defense will take a step back too far. I think they're going to come back down to earth.
Right.
And that's, they're going to continue to average these, the numbers are averaging.
Right. Right. And that's all that I mean, because I mean, that's, you're playing, again, you're playing teams, you know, in the Jets, Vikings, you know, I mean, Jets, Vikings, and Jaguars, which, yes, you lost to the Jaguars, but none of those teams have a lot of players on those teams that would really scare you. I mean, the Bears were 3-0 for a reason, like you said. They have Nick Foles. They have Allen Robinson. They've got David Montgomery. That is a team that, you know, I expected the Colts to win that game, but wouldn't have been surprised if they lost it. You know, if they had lost to the Jets, I would have been worried. I was worried when they lost to the Jaguars. I was worried when Philip Rivers against the Vikings drives down the field and throws an interception on the first drive of the game. So, you know, but
that wasn't his fault, though. That bounced right off of Mo Alley Cox's hands. He should have had that caught.
Very true.
So that's not a Philip Rivers interception. That's a it's an interception on a receiver.
Very true. But yeah, I think, you know, once you play stronger quarterbacks, that'll kind of show you what this defense is actually going to be. But yeah, I don't expect them to, you know, all of a sudden kind of take the nosedive that you saw in like 2006, which I understand that's a Super Bowl year, but like also where they just kind of were like, yeah, we just can't stop anybody anymore. And it's 44-17 against the Jaguars. So I don't expect that much of a decline, but I don't expect them to be number one in the league when the dust settles on 2020.
Oh, yeah. This isn't going to be like one of those defenses that's going to win you a Super Bowl alone. You know, like right. We've seen that in the past with the Ravens and, oh, the Buccaneers, you know.
The Seahawks.
The Seahawks, yeah. This isn't – I don't know. The Seahawks –
Well, but I'm just saying, like, as far as, like, when you think of Super Bowl winning defenses, like defenses that were kind of like will go down in history, it's the Seahawks, Buccaneers – it's the Ravens, it's the Bears. Like
I was looking more along the lines of
the defense.
The real reason they got there and won was because of their defense, and they had a quarterback that was just
look, just because
I mean Russell Wilson is a whole lot better than Brad Johnson.
Just because Trent Dilfer was literally released after the Super Bowl win doesn't mean he's not a fantastic quarterback, Scott. Come on, man. Oh gosh. But yeah, no, I see what you're saying. But yeah, it's not gonna this defense is not going to be, you know, in the rafters as one of the greatest defenses of all time, and they will need the offense to improve.
Could be in the rafters for as one of the greatest defenses of all time in Colts history.
Oh, true, very true.
Why can't the Colts just have like just figure it out and have like a good defense and a good offense at the same time? Why does it have to be one has to be really good and one has to be all at the same time? We could never have it be the same. Either you're really good at offense or you're really good at defense, and the other one is bad.
Yeah. The other
– I'll be honest. I think right now the offense for the Colts is bad.
Oh, yeah.
It is a bad offense. But at the same time, we've been so spoiled here in Indianapolis as Colts fans that having an offense that is – I mean, in our minds, it's bad, but, I mean, it's okay. It's good. It's, you know, it gets the job done. To us, that's a bad offense. It's not, if you're not putting up 35, 42 points a game, then why are you even out there on the field as call yourself an offense?
Right. Yeah. 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 It's definitely not an offense that we're used to by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm with you. I'm interested to see what might be open, you know, as far as the trade deadline, because the trade deadline for the NFL is nowhere near like the craziness of the MLB trade deadline, save for this year. But it has been a little bit more busy than typical years past. So it'll be interesting to see if the Colts
I think it'll be busier this year as well because of the fact you did not have a preseason.
True.
And you were not able to see kind of fully what everybody had. Because you see a lot of trades happen early in the year more so because of the preseason. But I think now this trade deadline, I think it could be busier just because you have a lot more injuries this year that teams are experiencing. And, you know, there's going to be teams that are going to be like, okay, we are in the area where we are going to basically be selling because we're have an opportunity to get a game-changing player. This upcoming draft has some really game-changing players. Or you're going to be one of those teams that go, okay, we are legitimate contenders, and we need something. We need a few pieces to help us become legit, become even bigger contenders. So I could see the Colts being one of those teams, but at the same time, it's Chris Ballard. He does not like to trade, you know, his draft picks. He likes to keep those. So it'll be interesting to see. Obviously, we always say, oh, yeah, they can make trades and whatnot, and then they don't. I think – where he'll be active is post trade deadline when teams make moves and then they cut players to make room for these new players. That's where he'll swoop in and pick some people up.
Hey, I mean, it's the tradition that I think a lot of media outlets and all that stuff have to go through. I mean, you know, we do it every year with the Pacers too. We say, this is who they could sign. and then they don't. And then, like, you see, like, teams will go, you know, you'll see beat writers for teams and they'll be like, this is who we can get. And then, like, literally nothing happens. So, hey, you know
I'm writing this because I'm being forced to write. We all know this isn't going to happen.
I need content. Like, look, B-Scott, we had a whole show of why it would make sense if LeBron came to Indy to be a member of the Pacers. So, oh, like,
content is king.
It is.
Speaking of content, I will say this. Like, we've experienced this before on this show, talking about the Indy 500 up here to back, and, you know, like how when anytime we talk about Scott Dixon and throw his name out there and the title and everything, how like our show is like this huge hit in New Zealand or wherever. And it's really interesting. Like I tweeted out pictures of Takuma Sato and doing that kind of salute. And that tweet blew up as far as like my personal account will blow up. And I cannot tell you who the people were that were liking it and retweeting it. Because everything was in Japanese. But because I wrote Takuma Sato, wow. Ping, 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 ping.
Right.
Folks, we're going to throw Takuma Sato's name in the title this week.
This we're going to talk about the Colts and the Big Ten, but our title is going to be why Takuma Sato has superseded Scott Dixon as the best IndyCar driver of all time. But like,
SEO.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I mean, it's true. Like, because the number one viewed memory lane episode is the one where we had Harrison's win over Kokomo in the sectional. And that's because I tagged Harrison's, I tagged Harrison in it and they retweeted it. And then like everybody from, I'm assuming, you know, that area liked it. And then, yeah, the Indy 500 super team where we talked about Scott Dixon as far as like recent podcasts too, that's like our most listened to podcast. So, I mean, it's just all, you know, the internet, the way the internet works sometimes is wild.
It's a mystery.
It is. Well, before we get into Big Ten football, we're going to kick it to our sponsors. We do have two this week, so bear with us. We gotta get those ads in. So we will see you on the other side. So B Scott, Power 5 football is officially back and ready to go. Not as far as playing, they're not back, but as far as like being on the schedule, being on the slate for the fall, the entire Power 5, actually the entirety of college football, has decided it's time to get things done here this fall instead of having things be postponed until the spring. The Big Ten announced their return to play in mid-September. It's going to be an 8-game schedule starting October 24th. So by the end of the month, we will have Big Ten football. Every team there's going to be an 8-game schedule. And then the 9th game, every team will play their division counterpart. Now, there are no byes, which that could present a little bit of an issue as far as like, what if you have like a situation like you have this week in the NFL with the Titans and the Steelers. But they reversed the decision on postponement due to improved COVID testing protocols and that kind of thing. So the Pac-12 also decided they will be back. They will be back November 7th. They're going to have a 7-game conference only schedule as well. Every conference plans to return to play this fall. So I think originally like the MAC, the Mountain West, the Pac-12, Big Ten, those guys had all decided they weren't going to play and now have reversed those decisions. So everybody will be back at some point this fall, which will be really cool to see. And so it's going to be cool because, you're looking into this season, I think it was, an interesting move, to bring everything back. It was kind of weird because, I was telling you, B. Scott, before we got going here, I was like, Pat McAfee brought it up the best. And I talked about it a little bit, on the podcast when we broke down everything, but, it's weird that you were going to have situations where Iowa State could play, but Iowa couldn't. IU and Purdue couldn't play, but Notre Dame could. So you kind of had like a weird crossover where, so if it's bad for one region to play, why is it not bad for this region to play? It's good to see that the Big Ten and the Pac-12 and everybody else has decided safely to come back.
Yeah, I'm glad to see that too. The Big Ten and the Pac-12, well, Pac-12 already is, but the Big Ten was looking to become a laughing stock. Like, really? You claim to be the toughest conference and, you can't play during this, but yet some of your states are allowing high school football to be played and teams from other conferences within your state are playing. Come on. Now, obviously, I do get it. I understand where the Big Ten presidents and athletic directors were coming from in making that decision. Honestly, they thought when them and the Pac-12 made this decision, they figured the Big 12, the SEC, and the ACC were going to follow suit as well. Obviously, that did not happen. And so they did what they had to do to have themselves be comfortable with returning to play and making sure that they were going to be able to put the safety of their athletes and staff ahead of competition. And they did that. Obviously, we can think, we'll talk about this a little bit more here in a moment, but I think the right things were done by, you know, either canceling or postponing the season and then making the decision to come back to play. However, I do believe that there was a major, major breakdown in communication from the Big Ten. I can't say much about the Pac-12 because the Pac-12, I feel like, is just a dumpster fire anyways. It just seems like, I mean, the Pac-12 was the one that the student athletes came out with a list of demands. And the Pac-12, they just are starting to seem, especially on the football stage, somewhat irrelevant. But with the Big Ten, I just feel like it was a major, major breakdown in communication between the public and the Big Ten offices and the universities. Now, I know that the public doesn't need it. The Big Ten doesn't have to tell us anything, you know, but kind of when you're hearing rumors of different things coming out from random people on Twitter, mainly a guy named Sir Yacht, that basically broke the Big Ten return story almost date for date, word for word, everything was given. He had inside sources behind the scenes within somebody's athletic department and was feeding, I mean, basically telling him what was going on behind the scenes. And it turns out that the Big Ten was even not fully transparent with its universities. You know, Kevin Warren, the commissioner, kind of went MIA for a moment and nobody could figure out what was going on, what were they needed to do. There was major division between the schools. Nebraska threatening to sue everybody and, you know, still threatening to sue everybody because they don't like their schedule, but whatever, that's Nebraska. So yeah, it felt like a bigger mess than what it really was. If you break it down to why it happened, why now they're coming back and everything, it all makes sense. But the fiasco and the major mess in between with the lack of communication is what really made this a laughing stock across the entire country.
Now, you know, like we talked about, there are some, you know, they thought the ACC and all of those conferences would follow suit. They've already come back. You take a look at the AP top 25, you know, you've got Clemson, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, and Notre Dame in that order. They make up the top five. Bama, Georgia, and Florida are the only SEC teams in the top 10, which I thought that was interesting, you know, because of the fact that, you know.
LSU lost.
Well, right, yeah, LSU lost, but it just.
I'm surprised Auburn.
Well, yeah, I mean, they
were seventh. Auburn lost to Georgia.
Right, but they were seventh, but I think had they not lost in such, you know, grand fashion, they probably would have stayed in the top 10. But that's what I'm saying is that those teams, with the exception of maybe Alabama or Florida, whoever wins the SEC will most likely lose one more game. So to see there not being other SEC teams there to kind of take over is interesting to see. And then, of course, Oklahoma, ripped to them. It'll be interesting to see if the Big 12, you know, what will happen with them, because Oklahoma is literally the only Big 12 team to ever make the college football playoff. And it doesn't look like that's going to happen this year. So,
It's a big, big, big deal. I'll tell you who's celebrating this. The SEC. The SEC right now, I mean, obviously we don't know what Ohio State's going to look like. Ohio State was obviously like preseason number one or number two.
Right.
And they have the talent. The talent has opted back into play. So obviously, I'm gonna, like, if I had to make a prediction right now, obviously Clemson, Ohio State, and I'm gonna go out on a limb and go Florida and Alabama as your four playoff teams. Georgia with their QB situation, I'm not really sure, but yeah, you're right. Florida, Georgia, and Alabama could all potentially have at least one loss on their resume. Because obviously Georgia and Florida have yet to play each other. I mean, right. They play at the world's largest outdoor cocktail party. And then
not this year.
The winner of that game. Essentially the winner of that game is Alabama.
Right. Yeah, and I think that there is a good chance there's going to be two. There's an even more heightened chance there's going to be two SEC teams in there this year. But I mean, you know, what'll be interesting is, you know, right now Ohio State's like sixth or seventh, I think, now, having not played a game. So it'll be kind of interesting to see kind of the drop and then the scale back up to see, you know, how fairly they get ranked. Not, you know, how they fare rankings wise. I didn't mean like they wouldn't be ranked fairly, but then like also, I mean, even though the Pac-12 is a dumpster fire, what do you do if, you know, I can see a Pac-12 team going 7-0, you know, depending on who they play, you know, if a team gets hot and gets the right schedule. So what do you do with them? Because you can't really say, well, they didn't play anyone in the non-conference. All they did was play in their conference, which is what they were meant to do. So it'll be very interesting to see what will happen. I mean, I don't think the Big 12 is out of it, because, I mean, right now Oklahoma State is number 10, and we'll talk about them in a second, because that is going
to – Don't sleep on Texas still. Don't sleep on Texas.
But they just lost to TCU, though. So there's
I know, but there's still a one-loss team.
Right. I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, if they come back, and especially what Texas needs is Oklahoma State to still do well, and then they need to beat Oklahoma State.
State's looking really good right now, other than the fact they lost opening weekend to Arkansas State.
Right. So, yeah, whoever – basically, if you're a one-loss Big 12 team, you need to run the table, and then you need Oklahoma State to be good except for the week they play you, and then you need to then beat them again in the Big 12 championship game. Like, that's basically the road for the Big 12 to get in.
I'm actually shocked about Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Them losing to Iowa State, I can see that, because they go into Iowa State in the past several times, and they've struggled there.
Yeah.
But the fact that they lost to K-State, who lost to Arkansas State opening weekend, I mean, they lost. They had a big lead on Arkansas State, and Arkansas State came back and won that game. It's kind of like, I almost kind of feel like, you know, there's going to be some head coaching openings in the NFL.
Yeah.
Lincoln Riley not having a good season. This could be the opportunity he has to jump. And we could potentially end up then seeing a downfall of Oklahoma. I know that's a lot of what ifs and speculation, but this could potentially be a cliff that Oklahoma is potentially falling off right now, depending on can they bring this thing together? That's two losses in a row, and they just haven't looked good in either one of them.
First of all, I am the one who wildly speculates things on this show, so I need you to keep your level head, and then I will do the heavy speculating. But no, I think the two losses are exacerbated by the fact that it's a Big 12 only schedule. The fact that they're 0-2 looks bad. They don't have, you know, Murray State and Army to pad their win-loss total at this point in the season. So that's why it looks worse than maybe it is. But I did expect maybe not this much of a decline. But, I mean, this is the first time Lincoln Riley has not had a Heisman Trophy future, you know, NFL quarterback. As
everybody thought Spencer Rattler was going to be it, though.
Well, right, but this is literally like, is he a sophomore? Like, this is literally, you know, he's never played before. You know, Jalen Hurts, Baker Mayfield, Kyler Murray had all played before and were like ready to go. So, but I do think it's interesting. I mean, you know, depending on how the Cardinals do, depending on how the Browns do, if the Browns kind of fall off, if Oklahoma's like, you know, at the end of they're playing what, nine? No, they're playing 10 games or 9 games. They're playing 9 games, aren't they? If they're like 6-3, 5-4, you know, maybe they say, hey, look, that Cliff Kingsbury, Kyler Murray tandem is doing pretty well. Let's go ahead and get that, you know, that tandem of Lincoln Riley and Baker Mayfield going to the NFL. So you might be right there. But But yeah, this is the first, I expected a decline from Oklahoma. And I think the fact that we're seeing, you know, conference only schedules, this is kind of what I expected from conference only schedules, is that it's going to make teams look really good or really bad, because they all, like, they only are playing their divisions. There's not the, you know, breakup of having a, you know, a cupcake to beat up on, you know, in the opening season to kind of get ready and get in rhythm. You're just thrown right to the wolves and told you're either going to sink or swim. So,
well, hey, the Big 12, you had that opportunity. I mean, look, Oklahoma beat Army.
That's true. Yeah.
One. K-State lost to Arkansas State week one.
Right.
So they did have that cupcake thrown in there for them.
That is true. So this week we do, because we've got B. Scott back here on the show, and it's not just, you know, my ramblings that you're listening to, we do bring back Hot or Cold. And it's going to be all college football geared. So the first question, hot or cold, the Big Ten's return was the right move. That's a hot take for me. The decision to postpone the season was made August 11th, which, I mean, you know, I thought about it because I thought it was made a lot sooner, but I forgot it was actually their decision to, like, you know, they made decisions, like, throughout the summer, but the official decision was made in August, but, you know, which is a month before the season. Which, you know, is kind of good in the sense that, like, okay, that gives everybody enough advance to kind of figure things out. But it also seems like this year, with as crazy as this year has been, a lot of decisions with sports have been made kind of at the last second. So you kind of, you know, thought, hey, maybe they did it a little bit too quickly. And the question, you know, you alluded to it a little bit, B. Scott, was, you know, was the decision made in good faith? Because originally, it was, you know, you'd like to believe that it was made because of the fact, you know, the facts that, you know, okay, well, we're not going to be able to put these guys in a bubble because, you know, they're students. They got to go to class. You know, basically the reasons that I listed off, you know, why Big Ten fans shouldn't have been, like, protesting in front of the headquarters or their local colleges, because it doesn't make sense, because, I mean, they're kids. They're college kids. They're going to, you know, it's going to be tough to, you know, coordinate and regulate what their, you know, actions are. So, you know, so that was kind of, you know, so that was obviously a thing that kind of, you know, makes you think, okay, maybe that was kind of the reason behind the testing. But then you hear, like, oh, well, they expected these other teams to do it too. Now they're reevaluating, you know, these other conferences to do it too. Now they're reevaluating, you know, whether or not they're going to make that decision. And then you know, have, you know, politicians getting involved and all that kind of stuff. So it kind of makes you think, you know, was the decision originally made in good faith, or was it made to look like, hey, we're the progressive, you know, leader, we're the leader of all college football and making this, you know, groundbreaking, breathtaking decision. And then they're like, oh, wait, nobody else is going to go with us on this. Ah, crap. Maybe we need to actually do, you know, maybe we actually need to play this fall. And I mean, it kind of made sense too, from the standpoint of, hey, the Big Ten, Pac-12 has always been like a conference rivalry with the Rose Bowl. Like, maybe you can make something, you know, cool out of the fact that they'd be playing in the spring. You know, you would have basically, you know, if Justin Fields decided to play, you know, he would be able to showcase his talents right before the draft and all that kind of thing. So that was, you know, kind of some interesting things that came out of it. But at the same time, you know, you kind of wondered, how in good faith was the decision to postpone it? Was it more of a publicity? This is, you know, this is going to be the PR move to make, or was it actually made for safety reasons? Now, at the end of the day, they do get improved testing, and which is a good thing. You know, as a selfish, you know, Big Ten fan, you know, seeing the fact that they're able to health, you know, they're taking all the health protocols they need to take into consideration, and the fact that they're going to be back is a great thing for me to hear. And so, you know, that's good. But, you know, you kind of wonder what the original decision was like. But I also have always thought, too, that college sports is kind of maybe the more easy sport, you know, level of sports to kind of mandate, because of the fact that it's all regionally based. You don't have, you know, you're not going to have Cincinnati playing a game, you know, in California. Ohio State's not going to go play Oklahoma for a conference game. Which you might have seen a few years ago if the conference realignment would have, you know, kept going the way it was going. But, you know, it's just kind of a thing where, you know, I feel like at the end of the day, the decision was maybe made a little bit too quickly. And I think they are good to have, you know, finally come to a decision that is good from a health standpoint, but also means they're going to be back this fall.
Yeah, I think this is a hot take as well. It's not even just going to affect, you know, the immediate future. If they decided to postpone the season and, you know, basically miss out the Big Ten missing out on the college football playoff and playing sometime in the spring, this was going to be a huge thing used against them in recruiting. And it would have been probably about five steps backwards on the recruiting trail. And that could have been a devastating blow to the talent of the conference. Not only that, but with the potential of the upcoming change in the transfer rules and everything, you could have seen a lot of the top talent in the Big Ten saying, forget this conference. I'm out of here. I'm going to go play somewhere where they actually are going to play. So this really kind of saved face for the Big Ten. I know there was a lot of – there was some coaches that were trying to save face for the Big Ten when they thought they were going to be playing in the spring. Like Jeff Brohm, for instance, came out with his own idea for how a spring schedule could work early on in the, like basically at the beginning of the calendar year. When nobody else was out there putting out ideas, they were just complaining. He was thinking proactively. So they were – I don't think that was because – oh, here's a plan. Let's try to get this pushed through. It was more along the lines of, hey, there was no football for us to be playing. We want to play football here, you know, telling that to recruits. You know, we weren't happy about the decision, but I definitely think it's a good thing because not only that is it good just because it's football, but the Big Ten actually has a legitimate shot of winning the college football playoff this year. Ohio State's one of the most experienced teams in the country, behind Clemson, this was a really good shot for them, and to have that taken away from them would have been disastrous for the conference. I am glad that they did push for more improved rapid testing. They have come out and said that they can schools can the program can attest up to 150 people between their team and program staff and everything. And that Nebraska has an issue with that because they're like, well, we have 170 people. Well, sorry. Just because you have a huge walk-on program doesn't mean we're going to change the rules just for you. Based off of, you know, what they can get and how accurate these tests can be. So, you know, I'm glad that I think the Big Ten not only helped them get improved testing for their players, but I think they may have helped improve testing and more rapid testing just for the general public as well. I think we're going to start being able to see these rapid saliva tests come out more so that you're not having to get your brain scraped when you go get tested for COVID. So I think because of that, there's a lot of good that's going to come out of this, not just for the Big Ten, but for the general public as well. And also just the psyche of everybody in the Midwest. I mean, we've all been cooped up in quarantine and we needed something to look forward to. And Big Ten football is one of those things that we look forward to here in the Midwest. And to have that taken away from us was like a big gut punch. And now to have it back, it actually gives you something to be excited about and look forward to. And I think that's going to help just the general public as well. It's going to make us happier. So definitely a hot take. And the Big Ten made the right move to return. Definitely.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely, you know, from the selfish standpoint of, like, more sports, we want things to do and watch and see. Like, yeah, definitely good stuff all the way around. Now, the next question I've got is, does the Pac-12 have a shot at the college football playoff? I'm going to say that's a cold take. My original pick to win the Big 12 was Oklahoma State. I think they're going to get in. I think it's going to be two SEC teams, Oklahoma State and Ohio State. Clemson. So, yeah, Clemson now probably bumps out that other team or other SEC team if the Big 12 or if the SEC, you know, gets two teams, whatever. Anyway, there's not going to be the Pac-12 in the college football playoff. Now, is there a chance? Because, I mean, honestly, right now, I don't know who even is the favorite to win the Pac-12. I know
Oregon. I don't think the Pac-12 even knows.
Yeah, I was like, you know, could it be Oregon? Could it be USC? Could it be? Now, it also depends on what team it is as well, because obviously I think if it's like Stanford, or a Utah or somebody like that that goes undefeated, I think they're going to be treated a little bit more like UCF than they will be treated like, you know, an Oklahoma or Florida. But if it's a big name like USC goes 7-0, you know, gets more eyeballs on that television screen, knowing that, you know, whoever is going to play, you know, the number one team, whether it be Clemson or Ohio State, is going to most likely lose anyway. Then we might see that. But, I think the Pac-12 is going to beat each other up The winner's going to have at least one or two losses, and that's going to be enough because the Pac-12, I don't think, is really taken seriously. We want to knock, some of the mid-major conferences, but I think the Pac-12, football-wise, is kind of skewing that direction.
Yeah, this is definitely a cold take. I don't think the Pac-12 is going to have anybody in there. One, they're starting so late in the season. They're starting early enough that they're still going to be eligible for the college football playoff. But by that point, a lot of teams are going to have made strong cases. I mean, heck, the Big Ten will be three games into that. They'll be their third weekend. So they'll be, a lot of teams will have made cases and they'll have some sort of eye test already done. And the fact that they're only playing seven games, it's going to be tough to put in an undefeated 7-win Pac-12 team over like an 8-1, 8-2, wherever, however many games an SEC team is playing, like 9-1 SEC team. You're not going to put in an undefeated Pac-12 team that played fewer games in a weaker conference than a one-loss SEC team. I don't see it happening. And again, it also comes down to the Pac-12 is just in a horrible time slot where all these voters and everything, by the time the marquee games for the Pac-12 are on, they're in bed.
Yep.
And I mean, that's nothing against the Pac-12. They can't fix that. That's nothing ever they're going to be able to fix. But I just don't see it happening for them this year with no clear-cut favorites, seven games, and starting the latest out of all the Power Five conferences. The odds are truly stacked against them.
I think they kind of know. They kind of know at this point. They're like, yeah, it probably doesn't look good for us. Now, the next three questions for Hot and Cold, they are geared specifically because when we did the preview for the other three conferences, B. Scott was still away. So I kind of wanted to kind of phrase them in a way that kind of lets you make your picks without being like, oh, well, it must be nice to make your picks for the season.
Hey, I kind of made my picks already too.
Yeah, you did. So I didn't expect you to do that, but these three questions are still geared for that to have, taken care of itself if you hadn't done that already. So the third question is, Miami has the best shot to take the ACC from Clemson. For me, that's a cold take. Miami, Notre Dame, are kind of the two highest ranks or the two teams you would think, mentally, hey, these are the two teams, these are the two programs that could possibly take the ACC championship away from Clemson. Notre Dame does host Clemson, although, I think I would be a smidge, not a lot, a smidge more worried if Notre Dame Stadium could be at full capacity if I were Clemson, but I don't think it's going to matter really too much. But those are also two programs that have struggled in big games as a program as of late. So I'm not really super confident in either of those two teams. And North Carolina's wins this season have been, even though they've been less impressive, they still feel like the team to me that has the best shot. So they do have wins over Syracuse and Boston College. Those are their two wins. They're not super impressive. But that team, I think, as a whole looks a little bit better. And they're a team that last year played Clemson very tough as well. So that's the team that I think will possibly, contend with Clemson. But I think Clemson ultimately, it doesn't have anything to worry about.
Yeah, I agree. I think the ACC is Clemson's to lose. Clemson's got a bunch to prove. They just didn't look quite fully Clemson last year. I guess still making it to the national championship game and not looking like your normal self, that's pretty darn good.
Right.
But, yeah, I'm not sure there really is anybody in the ACC that can really give them a good run. Notre Dame is who I thought they were. They just – Miami, I don't know. A few plays go against Miami, and they just fall. They fall apart. They're one of those teams that they're constantly teetering on the edge of a complete meltdown. And if Clemson hits a few big plays against them, bam, done. Clemson walks in that one. North Carolina, though, is an interesting team, being ranked so highly. Mack Brown has got that team in a good position. And I think that could, like you said, do they have, I think they're the ones that have the most likely chance, but are they? No. I still think the ACC is Clemson's to lose, and I don't think anybody's going to take it from them. If Clemson does not win the ACC, it's because Clemson lost the ACC and what didn't play up to their potential.
Next question is, Oklahoma State will be in the college football playoff. For me, that's a hot take. They're right now, they're the Big 12 leaders. They were my pick to win the Big 12, and now that Oklahoma has lost two games, that really opens the door. No other Big 12 team has made the college football playoff besides Oklahoma, and I think that the door is wide open. And I think Oklahoma is the best team. I mean, their offensive line, and they have basically returned their offensive line and top rusher from last year, and the running back was one of the best runners in the country. They're always a good passing team as well. And then now that Oklahoma doesn't look like they're going to be quite the Oklahoma we're used to, I think they do have a legitimate shot to possibly run the table. And if they do lose a game, it's most likely going to be against the team that they play in the Big 12 title game. And then in that scenario, if they can win that game, they'll be in good shape as well. So I think Oklahoma State will be in the college football playoff. So that's a hot take for me.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a hot take as well. If they can just run the table, do what they're doing, continue. Oklahoma State has one thing, though. They typically get in their own way at some point in time. Mike Gundy is, in my opinion, one of the better coaches out there, one of the more underrated coaches. I mean, obviously, he's done good to be there for as long as he's been there. Wasn't it like the 10-year anniversary last week of the meltdown that we love the most?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's definitely a hot take. One of the things that stand out from the teams that make the college football playoff is they always have at least one player that is highly marketable and a coach that is highly marketable, whether it be Ohio State with Urban Meyer and Ezekiel Elliott, or Nick Saban and Tua Tagovailoa, or, Dabo Sweeney and whoever his quarterback is, whatever it may be, there are those marketable names and faces. Oklahoma State's got that this year. You have Mike Gundy at head coach, and let's be honest, he's marketable, very, very marketable. And Chuba Hubbard at running back, I think him returning to compete his senior year was probably one of the biggest decisions and one of the biggest boosts for Oklahoma State. Because Oklahoma State always has like talented wide receivers and a quarterback that can manage the game well and get the ball to his wide receivers. But one of the things they've missed in helping that team is a solid running game. And Chuba Hubbard gives them not just a solid running game, but a very good running game. So this is a dangerous team, a dangerous Oklahoma State team. And, now with Oklahoma kind of basically falling off the wagon, Texas being, Texas, I think it does give Oklahoma State a really good shot, as long as Oklahoma State can stay out of their own way and just take care of business. They always come out of the, they can sometimes look like they're going to be really, really good, and then they fall apart. I think there's just, sometimes they have too much locker room turmoil, and that really affects them.
Final question. Alabama will win the SEC. That's a hot take for me. They're fourth in the SEC in yards per game, third in the country in points per game. After LSU they are unequivocally the best team in the SEC West. I don't think Auburn showed this past weekend they're not very good. Not very good, but it's not the team that can, hang with Alabama. Texas A&M, is the team that Alabama ran all over this weekend. That was kind of another team that could have been a potential, roadblock for Alabama as far as the West is concerned. So I think now you kind of know that Alabama is the team to beat. And then, of course, I would bet on Nick Saban to win the big game against the Georgia, Florida winner. So I think Alabama is the easy choice to win the SEC. It's just a matter of where they're going to be ranked for the college football playoff, whether they'll be able to leapfrog Clemson and get a team like a second SEC opponent like a Florida, or whether they're going to get Oklahoma State, or what kind of team they're going to be facing in round one. But I think they are going to have the fast track to the college football playoff.
Yeah, I agree. I don't want to agree because you just get tired of the same old, but Georgia has
that's
some
all, question marks. That's all the college football playoff has been. Like, it's literally been the same four teams for, like, the last four years. I mean,
but, you know, Georgia has question marks at quarterback. Florida, I don't know. I'm waiting for them to stumble on one because they always seem to do that. So I'm not 100% sold on them. I kind of feel like they boosted up the rankings because the Big Ten isn't playing. Georgia, I'm actually surprised that they're playing as well as they are, especially when they found out that quarterback transfer Jamie Newman was opting out. That kind of left them in a tough spot. But Alabama, I mean, you just look at that roster, and top to bottom is extremely talented. I mean, this is going to remind you of those Alabama teams of old where they had a serviceable quarterback. He was good, but he wasn't like NFL good. Who was their quarterback when they beat Notre Dame?
And AJ all they talked about.
Yeah, and all they could, well, all Brent Musburger could talk about was AJ McCarron's girlfriend the entire time. That was the most awkward football game I've ever watched. Yeah. That was painful, not just because of what was going on in the field, but what was going on in the broadcast booth. Absolutely painful. But yeah, it's hard to bet against Alabama. Like, there's just not that. If they have question marks, they're very, very small question marks. And I don't know. And it's one of those until somebody can prove me wrong, you go with Alabama, essentially.
Yeah. I mean,
I think they can win the national championship. No, I don't think Alabama's national championship good because of the talent on Clemson, on Ohio State, and how good those quarterbacks are. But Alabama is a playoff team, and Alabama's SEC champion worthy.
Oh yeah, for sure. I think you know they're going to be there for sure. And then yeah, I mean once they get in the playoff, kind of who knows? It's kind of a toss up as far as Alabama's concerned. You know, they've won some, they've lost some, so it will definitely be interesting to watch. That will do it for this week's edition of the Crash Course Podcast. I want to remind you to follow us on our Twitter page at Crash Course FM. Remember to subscribe to the YouTube channel, Crash Course Podcast, new episode of Memory Lane, the 10th episode of Memory Lane dropping on Friday, so you won't want to miss that. Also, like us on Facebook, Crash Course Podcast, and then you can listen every week on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever podcasts can be heard, you can find the Crash Course Podcast. We will be back next week for another one. But until then, have a good week, everybody.